You're listening to the Archaeology Podcast Network.
Welcome to The Past Macabre, where we journey through history to uncover how our relationship with death reflects the values, fears, and hopes that shape the way people live. I'm your host, Stephanie Rice. Thank you for joining me for episode 30, The Archaeology of the Real Scorpion Kings. The modern Scorpion King, popularized by film and games, is very loosely inspired by two different pre-dynastic Egyptian rulers who were identified with the scorpion symbol. The movies depict a warrior king whose power is born from a series of military conquests that were started ultimately for vengeance. But this vision reflects a modern obsession with violence as the origin of civilization, and it completely glosses over how unsustainable that would actually be. The archaeological evidence shows that the earliest Egyptian kingship was not founded primarily on military conquest, but on agricultural prosperity, trade, and innovation. Don't worry, this episode is not a scene-by-scene critique of the historical inaccuracies of the Scorpion King. We'd be here for hours. In this episode, I'll share information about Scorpion I of Abydos, who ruled around 3320 BCE, and Scorpion II of Nechen, who ruled around 3100 BCE. Together, they reveal the foundations of kingship in ancient Egypt and the beginnings of sacred traditions that lasted for thousands of years and basically became Egypt as we know it. So now let's get started on our look at the real Scorpion Kings. As we get started, I just want to clarify a little bit about the name. So King Scorpion is a modern scholarly label, not a preserved personal name or a translation of a title from ancient Egypt. This period, when King Scorpion I and King Scorpion II lived, marks the very, very beginnings of hieroglyphic writing. So the symbols were pictorial and very context-driven instead of fixed linguistic signs that had set meaning like later hieroglyphic writing does. So it's not an easy one-to-one translation to fully understand what they were trying to convey whenever they showed the scorpion sign underneath the Horus falcon in what's called a seric, which is a rectangular boundary of the name or title symbols, which is kind of the precursor to the cartouche that surrounds royal names and god names in later hieroglyphic texts. So as far as King Scorpion goes, we don't know if this was a title. Maybe it's the early beginnings of the Horus name, which was one of the titles chosen whenever a ruler actually ascended to the throne. It could have been a lineage symbol. Maybe King Scorpion I and King Scorpion II were actually related from the same like family lineage. We don't really know. It could have been like a family crest almost in that case, sort of like medieval Europe. It could have just been a powerful animal image because scorpions are kind of scary, kind of badass, and so it could have just been adopted independently by two separate rulers just for the meaning behind it. Again, not very sure because there's not an exact text that was left for us that lays out what exactly the scorpion symbol means. There's even a lot of debate about the true identity of King Scorpion II, and some debate that he might have actually been Narmer, a different way to denote Narmer, the king who unified Egypt as far as we know in the archaeological record. But I'll get into that whenever we get around to King Scorpion II. First, I'll start with Scorpion I, who shows us kind of the beginnings of administration and trade and a consolidation of power at Abydos in Upper Egypt. He would have lived around 3350 to 3250 BCE. So again, before the unification of Egypt, long before the pyramids, in the era that archaeologists refer to as the Nakata III period. And as I said earlier, it's sometimes referred to as the proto-dynastic era because it's this quote-unquote dynasty zero just before the dynastic era truly begins as we understand it. So Egypt during this time was a lot of independent regional centers. Some of them were interlinked through trade, and some of them were not allied at all and would be going at each other through warfare. Abydos, Nekin, sometimes known as Hierakonpolis, and Nakata are the main three competing regional centers during this period in Upper Egypt that were sometimes cooperating, sometimes competing for the various resources of the Nile Valley. The reason why archaeologists separate these regional power centers is based on the cultural artifacts that are found that are very distinctly separate in certain periods and made a certain way in these three regions. So it's not just kind of an arbitrary regional assignment based on the location of the cities. It's based on the material culture that's been found by archaeologists in these areas. Near Abydos is one of the oldest royal necropolises in Egypt. It's now known as El Kab, which translates to Mother of Pots, because throughout the millennia that this cemetery area was used, lots and lots of bits of pottery, potsherds have popped up as the sand shifts everything away. It looks just like a field of broken pottery. So it's also been associated with the quote unquote tomb of Osiris, the mythical tomb of Osiris. And so a lot of pilgrims would leave potsherd votive offerings here as well, where they were already broken pots when they brought them here, and they would have notes on them that were essentially meant to be carried into the underworld to Osiris. One specific tomb here at El Kab is in Cemetery U, and so it's designated as Tomb UJ. It's the largest and most architecturally complex tomb from the pre-dynastic period that's been found at any of the cemeteries that have royal and elite burials during that period. So most likely, this has been identified as the tomb of a ruler who very likely consolidated Upper Egypt, if not even further regions, based on the artifacts that have been found in his tomb. During this time period, tomb architecture was evolving and becoming more complex. So similar to the other elite tombs around it, the tomb is dug into the ground in a pit and then lined with walls that are made of mud brick and then sometimes plastered over. And in this case, there were 12 different rooms also built with mud brick walls to separate them. And it was designed to imitate a large elite house or even a royal palace. Instead of just the simple burial chamber, then offering chamber, and sometimes other elite tombs from the period might have had like a third or fourth chamber for additional offerings or as the beginnings of this home-like tomb structure. But here it is all out with you have multiple rooms. One's even been designated as a hallway, but also each of these rooms actually have the hangings for wall mats that would have been used essentially as doors. So these mats would have been placed over these doorways or windows, depending on the size, and used like screens. And then they could be rolled up whenever you needed air to circulate through the house when they were used on the house. Well, here in this tomb, they were fully equipped with mats that could actively be rolled up, even though a lot of the spaces that they were placed over weren't the same size that a living body could go through. So we see that this was actually built to be the house for the soul, and it even comes with all the trappings of a house. The roof itself, the remnants that have been found, was made with large acacia wooden beams. Wood is definitely a prized commodity in the desert, even if you do have some of the more localized woods accessible, instead of having to, for example, like import cedar, like later traditions had with a lot of the royal sacred barges and a lot of the sacred temple architecture. So you have a lot of money that's going into this, essentially. You have these large, fancy wooden beams, and a lot of effort is being put into making this look like a actual livable home. And then those beams on the roof were covered with matting, just the same as homes would have been at the time, like woven mats made of grass, reeds, date palm leaves, that sort of thing. And then it was still covered over like a tomb would have been. So all of this extravagant effort went into making this look like a home that nobody other than the deceased was going to ever see. As if the level of detail with the architecture itself isn't impressive enough, the contents of this tomb are also how we know that this was a very important individual. This holds the very first examples of writing from ancient Egypt. There are over 400 bone tags that are inscribed with proto-hieroglyphic symbols that were found mostly along trade goods. So we see these jars and boxes, essentially, all of these containers that were pulled from across Egypt, not just Upper Egypt. A lot of the tags identify different places that these came from, and some of the places that have been identified on the bone and ivory tags are in the Nile Delta. And some of the residue that's been tested on some of the untagged jars actually show that they were once filled with wine and grapes that came from the Levant, or like modern day Palestine, Syria area. So we already have this very elite individual, most likely a ruler, who is showing a ton of wealth that is unheard of during this period. There's no level of tomb finds from the pre-dynastic period that are on par with this at all. In fact, Nadi Narmer's tomb is this big and fancy. So it goes to show that the person who was in this tomb was a very important individual. They were able to consolidate trade from international places, and they were able to pull together all of these tributes from across Egypt, not just Upper Egypt, but also from Lower Egypt, from the Nile Delta. The wine jars, again, as I said, that come all the way from the Levant, they aren't just made with Egyptian pottery. They're made with Canaanite pottery, which was the name for the people who lived in that area during the time. And so, again, a highly efficient level of trade to be able to have enough to bury these with someone for eternity. So it would probably not have gone over well if these were literally the only sources of these goods, and then they were just buried with this guy. He had to have enough influence that his predecessors ensured that this happened, because when he's dead, he can't really make sure that everything stays in his tomb. So his predecessors ensured that this happened, and presumably everyone at the time was okay enough with him getting these goods that most archaeologists would assume that meant that a lot of elites had access to these goods during this period. And this hoard, so to speak, is to show the additional wealth that this ruler had and was able to keep providing themselves in the afterlife. Now, in addition to the perishable trade goods and all of these jars, there's also lapis lazuli beads, which does not come from anywhere in Egypt. Lapis lazuli comes from northeastern modern Afghanistan, which is over 3,000 miles away from where this person was buried. So this tomb obviously had, the tomb owner obviously had some access to trade goods around the world. Obsidian as well was found here. Again, I repeat it, but this would not have come from Egypt. Obsidian comes from sources like modern-day Yemen or modern-day Ethiopia, not near Abydos. One of the reasons why archaeologists have determined that this is the tomb for King Scorpion I is specifically because a lot of the goods are stamped with the scorpion symbol. As I said previously, the scorpion symbol had the falcon head on top, which was kind of the precursor to the royal names that we saw later. And on top of that, within the tomb itself, there was also an ivory scepter called the Heka scepter, which is one of the major symbols for kingship in Egypt that lasted from the early dynastic period onward. And so now we can see that it was also a very important symbol to be used during the pre-dynastic period as well, for it to be made out of ivory and then buried with this important person. So here we see King Scorpion's major show of his rule coming through a huge display of organized labor, administration, and trade goods. I mean, even excess food surplus, because there's also local Egyptian foods that are in the tomb as well. So clearly the major focus for this tomb is more so the trade connections, because again, we don't see very many weapons. A lot of the trade goods are perishables and beads and more ritualistic items. And even still, there are blades, but not as many in comparison to some other tombs where we very clearly refer to them as a like warrior king or pharaohs that were more famous for being militaristic. And this important snapshot of the beginnings of hieroglyphic writing also shows that this original kingship that we see all of these symbols that became sort of the basis, the foundations of kingship later, are all centered around abundance and trade and connectivity and not so much militaristic control. Rather than a warlord conquering his way from Upper Egypt to the Levant, we see a ruler who's establishing relationships across Egypt and the Levant to connect and unify. During that period, it probably would have been impossible to maintain that much power across that much land by militaristic force alone. Similar to the first Scorpion King, we see evidence that agricultural abundance and trade connections were important under the reign of Scorpion II. We don't know where his tomb is. Evidence of Scorpion II comes from the main temple at Nekin. It was called Hierakonpolis, or City of the Hawk by the Greeks, and that's because Nekin developed around the oldest temple dedicated to Horus, and it continued to be viewed as the sacred city of Horus for thousands of years. It's in Upper Egypt, about 150 kilometers south of Abydos. Scorpion II ruled around 3150 BCE to about 3050 BCE, and he would have lived just before or possibly at the same time as Narmer, who is the king that Egyptologists widely accept as the king to first unify all of Egypt. That's thanks to an artifact known as the Narmer Palette, which was found at Nekin, and it shows Narmer with the crown of both Upper and Lower Egypt. And this is the first depiction of a king wearing both crowns. So that's why he's given credit for unifying Egypt. In the same deposit, though, is the Scorpion Mace Head, which it doesn't show King Scorpion wearing both of the crowns of Egypt, but it does show him actually performing a ritualistic form of agriculture. He's digging canals, wearing the full ceremonial dress, and he's surrounded by people. There's servants helping to plant things. There's also people behind him holding palm fronds to cover him from the shade. So this shows us that King Scorpion II was not only known for being some sort of warlord or militaristic leader. It was very important for them to carve this large limestone ceremonial object with their ruler performing this agricultural feat. Scholars have interpreted this imagery as one of the earliest visual representations of the king's role as the sustainer of life and cosmic order. Based on the context that it was found in, as well as the artistic style, this could not have been the same King Scorpion that was buried at Abydos. So King Scorpion II would have lived several generations after King Scorpion I, and still there was this importance of abundance placed on kingship and not so much warfare. And similar to King Scorpion I, there is evidence that Scorpion II didn't only control Upper Egypt. Several artifacts bearing Scorpion II's symbol, Inisarik, which is the early version of the cartouche, which bore the kingship names in later periods in Egypt. And these include a wine jar from what we now call Minisha Abu Omar in the Delta region. So that was very far north of Nekin. This shows the economic reach far northward into the Delta. There have been other artifacts found along the Nile Valley in between, but this is one of the most important given the location of it and how far away it would have been from its place of origin. So we see here a span of several generations where there are two kings with the same name, or at the very least the same symbol, who have these ties and connections all across Egypt prior to the time period we know as the unification period under Narmer. Again, we don't know how connected Scorpion I and Scorpion II were. We don't know if this was some sort of like family sigil. It could simply be that King Scorpion II was building on the work that was done by his predecessors, whether they were related or not. Or it could have been just simply that given how Egypt can be a harsh landscape if you don't understand the cycles of the Nile properly, people probably only saw kingship for long periods as people who could actually sustain life there. Agricultural innovations and trade connections would have been literal life or death for people in certain parts of the Nile Valley. So it's easy to understand how somebody with these sorts of connections or intelligence, or at the very least, the ability to command enough people to figure this out so that they can continue to sustain the people of Egypt. As more and more artifacts associated with King Scorpion II especially have been found, archaeologists have been rethinking what we knew about the beginnings of dynastic Egypt. It's been theorized that Scorpion II was the last ruler of Upper Egypt, and Narmer defeated him in order to unify Egypt. But now some researchers are suggesting that Scorpion II may have actually unified Egypt before Narmer did, at the very least on an economic level. That would likely make Narmer Scorpion II's direct successor if this were the case, because there would not have been time for any sort of military conquest or succession war, nor is there any evidence of it other than the Narmer palette showing Narmer in what's become known as the smiting pose. So it's been interpreted that meant that Narmer unified Egypt through warfare. Again, reinterpretations are starting to happen that perhaps that shows Narmer subduing some rebellions on the frontiers or potentially expanding the boundaries of Egypt instead of using military might in order to unify Egypt. It's also possible, given the dating of the artifacts associated with Scorpion II and Narmer, that they were the same person, since rulers from later periods had multiple royal names and used them interchangeably depending on the circumstances. It's not like every single monument to Ramses II says Ramses plastered on it. Some of them actually have variations of his different throne names that usually, on average, throughout Egyptian history, most rulers had five throne names. And just like with the scorpion symbol, researchers haven't actually figured out if Narmer was a proper name or a title. It is actually just spelled with the catfish symbol and a chisel. So with a literal interpretation of those symbols, the same way that we do scorpion too. We would call Narmer like stinging catfish or angry catfish based on the interpretations of those symbols at the time. So again, it's kind of hard to tell if that would have actually been a name or if that would have been more of a title. And then, as I mentioned before, the most famous artifacts related to Scorpion II and the most famous artifact related to Narmer were found at the same temple deposit in Necken. So either that temple was seen as very important to early kingship, which, again, also a very likely possibility because Horus was heavily associated with kingship. So those deposits could be simply ritual deposits of multiple forms of kingship that came through the early dynastic period and pre-dynastic period. It takes more and more evidence, which we're getting every year as more excavations are happening, to try to piece these together. And every now and then, Egyptologists do come together to sort of reinterpret with new knowledge. So it's not like it's set in stone that Narmer had to be the one to unify Egypt. If more evidence shows that it wasn't him or Scorpion II is the same as him, then we'll reevaluate that and see what the evidence says. But whether they were different people or possibly even the same person, there was so much overlap based on all of the dating done with these artifacts and other things found with the artifacts that, as I said, there would have been no time for any sort of like secession crisis or another sort of militaristic wave coming through and completely subduing all of Egypt from one ruler to the next. Therefore, it is at least accurate to say that Scorpion II laid the foundations, at the very least economically and agriculturally, for Narmer to unify Egypt very soon after. As I've shared, the two rulers that we call Scorpion I and Scorpion II show that Egypt wasn't built by conquest alone. Sustainable unity was grounded in trade, agriculture, and maintaining balance with the natural world. In Abydos, Scorpion I chose to fill his tomb with the products of his expansive network of trade goods that connected all of the Nile Valley and far into modern-day Afghanistan, Palestine, and Ethiopia. The fact that these things were important enough to be taken to the afterlife stands as material proof that early kingship was shown through prosperity. At Necken, the artifacts from Scorpion II's reign reflect a similar vision of prosperity and order. The scenes carved onto the ceremonial mace head show a ruler overseeing agricultural advancements and not so much battles. And the vessels and jars that were marked with his name and found as far north as the Delta do show that, like his predecessor, Scorpion II's power extended outside of Upper Egypt through trade networks. Unlike the cinematic Scorpion King, the real Scorpion Kings shaped Egypt as we know it with a legacy rooted in agricultural sustainability, balance, and renewal. In their world, power was not just the ability to take life, but the divine responsibility to sustain life. Thanks for joining me for episode 30. And in the next episode, I'll be sharing the tombs of the tomb builders and what they can tell us about the real labor behind the most famous monuments of Egypt. Until next time.
Thanks for listening. Be sure to subscribe to keep up with new releases. Please leave a rating and a comment. That helps the show reach others who may be interested in the past macabre. For access to bonus content from all Archaeology Podcast Network shows, become a member at archpodnet.com/members. That's archpodnet.com/members. You can find show notes for this and other episodes at archpodnet.com/TPM. And follow Past Macabre on Instagram. That's PAST_MACABRE. You'll find pictures of the sites and artifacts discussed, Q&A sessions, and episode topic votes. Hope to see you there.
The Archaeology Podcast Network is 10 years old this year. Our executive producer is Ashley Airy. Our social media coordinator is Matilda Siebrecht. And our chief editor is Rachel Roden. The Archaeology Podcast Network was co-founded by Chris Webster and Tristan Boyle in 2014 and is part of Cultural Media and DigTech LLC.
This has been a presentation of the Archaeology Podcast Network. Visit us on the web for show notes and other podcasts at www.archpodnet.com. Contact us at chris@archaeologypodcastnetwork.com.